Welcome to Cider Chat. This week, it's Apples 101, meaning we're going to be going into a bit of the history of where apples came from and why the apples in the grocery store are not necessarily a great representation of the wide spectrum of apples that are both great for eating and making cider. Hello, my name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am the producer and cider MC of this weekly podcast, where we speak with makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade from around the world.
Hip, hip, hooray!
It's the fall. Are you making cider? Most likely you are if you're listening to this here podcast, but if you're not, don't worry. There is so much great cider to be had, and it's really getting better and better and better with so many makers who have kind of come on board in the past 10 years or so, and they're, you know, fine-tuning. And then even more recently, makers who have just started. I mean, the amount of information available just here on this podcast, we have a number of episodes for Beginning Cider Maker. There's a Cider Making 101 that you could go to. I'll put a link in the show notes to that. So if you're kind of like stumbling along, and then all these follow-up episodes with Ryan Monkman talking about, you know, bottle conditioning, our dear Ryan Monkman from Fieldbird Cider up in Ontario. So if you are new to this, you are in the right place. So grab a glass, sit back, enjoy the ride. Of course, if you're driving, keep your eyes focused. And for my friends out there in the Netherlands and those bike riding communities, maybe you're in Chicago, cranking around on the streets, be safe and, you know, listen along, but you know, definitely keep your eyes on the road and wait till you have that cider until you get to your destination. I'm like a little mother hen. I can't help myself. Anyways, first thing I want to say is, you know, there's great folks who support this podcast. This is listener-supported podcasting. We also have sponsors. In fact, I'll be talking about some of the sponsors coming up. But we have some cool folks who are in the website called Patreon, which is a website that helps content providers like myself support the work that we do, in this case, a podcast. And I just heard from a longtime patron of Cider Chat. His name is Carl Oli, and he has a book that he's going to send out to the next person that signs up at the Cider Chat Patreon page at $10 a month, and is a book by Aaron James called Tasting Cider. So he just wanted to like do this because I tell you, this is how cool the people that help support this podcast. So those of you who feel you can't support it for whatever reason, maybe you can't. I know sometimes it's just a matter of just getting online and plugging it in and, you know, we're busy lives. But anyways, so you can listen. So thank you, Carl. It's awesome. We're going to keep on talking about this until somebody signs up at the $10 a month, which is really like the cost of like two cans of ciders. Pretty good deal for a lot of content. In fact, we're going to be going over an hour in this particular episode this week. So once again, if you want this Aaron James book, along with some extra bonus stuff that you get at the Cider Chat Patreon page, Carl is looking for the next person who signs up at the Raise a Glass subscription. That's $10 a month. And once you're on that Patreon page for a while, you get a t-shirt too. You get to, you know, go to the Tee Public Cider Chat store and we set you up with a t-shirt. So extra bonus. And what, you don't know about the Cider Chat Tee Public store? Yes, there's a Cider Chat swag store. There's so much going on in Ciderville. Lots of fun designs. In fact, there's going to be a new design coming out for the 300th episode. Kind of a fun little thing. So hang on to your hats for that. I'll be talking about it once we get to episode 300. Wow, so much going on. So once again, thank you, Carl, up there in Vermont. You rock, and all the patrons and folks who donate, you really knock my socks off. Thank you so much. Now, you just heard one way that this podcast stays on the air, because it's listener-supported, but we also have sponsors. And I have the privilege of talking about two sponsors right now, beginning with the Northwest Cider Club. They're based out in the Pacific Northwest, and they have a cider box that rolls out each quarter. And this quarter right now is the Big Sky Cider Box. So you have the areas of Montana and Idaho, and one special cider coming out of Oregon using McIntosh apples from Montana. So this is Terroir, baby, terroir, right there. You get to go right into the Bitterroot Valley from the comfort of your home and taste what these incredible cider makers are doing. And if you don't know them, I've had a bunch of them on the podcast recently. We heard from the folks at Lockhorn Cider down in Boise. We heard from Western Cider in Missoula, Montana. And then we heard from the first cider maker ever to open commercially in Montana, Lee McAlpine. She is based in Darby, Montana, where they film a TV show. But you're going to have to hear her talk about it because it's kind of hilarious. That was a couple episodes back. I'll have a link in the show notes to those episodes. And I hope that really encourages you to sign up at nwciderclub.com/podcast and get their cider box today, because this is the last week. They might be able to squeak you in if you hear this like a week later, but if you're listening to this episode in January 2022, I'm sorry, you're going to be looking, you're going to have to look at the next cider box. And you know it's going to be great because they are putting a great compilation together. And this could be a subscription service where, you know, every kind of quarter you get a new cider box. Figure it out, find out what you want to get. Do know this makes a fantastic gift. And I have been drinking these ciders and I'm wowed. I'm wowed and I want to go to Montana. And I have the Northwest Cider Club to blame for that, including the amazing makers that are there too. So one more time, it's really easy to do. Do it today so you could get in on this amazing box. Just go to nwciderclub.com/podcast. The American Cider Association invites you to their 12th annual CiderCon, a global cider conference for cider professionals. CiderCon is taking place February 1st through the 4th, 2022, in beautiful Richmond, Virginia, at the heart of a celebrated cider region. With tours, tasting, educational workshops, demos, and more, CiderCon's return to an in-person event is bound to be one of the most energetic CiderCons to date. Special highlights this year include some awesome sessions delving into cider's flavors and terroir. Cider and food pairing expert Jenny Dorsey will walk you through a pairing framework with tasting samples that you can take back to your business, train your staff, watch your customers swoon, and see your sales grow. Renowned cider maker Diane Flynn will lead a panel on Southern cider apples. You will learn about old Southern apple varieties suited for cider and acclimated to the warm growing conditions we all face today. And Dan Pucci, co-author of the recently published book American Cider, will lead a panel discussion on the true crab non-Malus domestica apples, looking at growing conditions and how they can be used in cider making. Tickets to CiderCon are just $435 if you book by January 20th. To learn more about the wide array of events and educational sessions being offered and to register for CiderCon, head to ciderassociation.org today. CiderCon is an ACA member event produced with the generous support of members and sponsors. Learn how to become an ACA member or sponsor today by going to ciderassociation.org. For those regular listeners out there in Ciderville, you know that I have been rolling out little mini audio clips from past seasons as we're counting up to episode 300. Last week's episode, we were in season 3. This week, I have two little audio clips from season 4. And I'll tell you, it was not easy. Beginning with episode 151, which was titled The Sweet and Sour Side of Cider Podcasting, also known as Don't Fuck with the Cider Podcaster episode, I would say that season 4 started off in kind of an odd and strange way, and there's just a lot in this that I'd look at these different titles, like Journey to the Largest Apple Tree, that was with Claude Jacquelier, as he was talking about his trip to Kazakhstan, episode 153, and then the next episode was Sexism in the Cidery, that was a panel discussion of women talking about their stance on what's kind of going, not their stance, I should say, but really what happened to them as makers and producers. And maybe they're taking a stand, but they're really kind of sharing it. And it's poignant. It's very poignant. Had a great workshop with Kurt Scheer on Not All of These Are Gross. And now we're going to roll this little clip from County Cork's Killahora Orchard. And This is a really fun clip because it's singing, and I think that's where I'd like to kind of start this piece here. If you don't know about Kilahora or Barry Walsh and his cousin, they won an amazing award back in 2018 for their Wild Apple Bush, and it won the Supreme International Championship for International Ciders at the Royal Bath and West Cider Competition. Yeah, so they got it going on. So listen to this song. It's sung by Barry, and it's an Irish folk drinking song called Johnny Jump Up.
Let me tell you a story that happened to me. One day as I went down to Yall by the sea, the sun it was hot and the day it was warm. I figured a quiet pint would do me no harm. I went in and I asked for a bottle of stout, and the barman said, sorry, but the beer is sold out. Try whiskey or paddy, 10 years in the wood. I said I'd try cider, I heard it was good. No, never, no, never, no, never again, if I live to be 100 or 110. I fell to the ground and I could not get up, after drinking a quart of that Johnny Jump Up.
If you want to hear the full song sung by Barry Walsh of Kilahora Orchard and hear the backstory of this amazing cidery based in Ireland, go to episode 157 in season 4. The next little audio clip I recorded while I was at a cider fest. Remember those? They were so much fun. This one took place in Santa Cruz, California, and it comes from episode 187 titled We Want More Cider. And you're going to hear a little ditty coming rolling in right now from the song We Like Cider that I wrote and my cousin Jay and I sing.
There is a reason why we do it like this, but there is a reason why we drink it like this, there is a reason.
Hi, this is Jay Brizzle. I am from all over the U.S. I've lived in almost every state. I've been drinking cider since before you were born. My favorite style of cider is anything with berries, olive berry, cherry, blackberry, all that good stuff. My favorite food to eating cider, tacos, any kind of taco, the good stuff. What I want to know about cider is, where do I get it and where do I get more?
I just love how this guy, Jay, is just straightforward and saying, one thing I want to know about cider is how can I get more? Talk about sound bites. Just incredible. That was a fun episode because I have a number of cider makers in the beginning part, and then I talked to folks attending the Hardcore Cider Festival. It took place in April of 2019. Yow, dang. I think that's true. I don't even know anymore. It was season 4. That's all that counts. It's all like a blur, but it was such a good blur indeed. Anywho, that's amazing, right? When I come back, we're going to be rolling into the feature presentation on Apple's like 101 with Sean Turley and William Mullen. This past October, I was at Scott's Farm just over the border in Vermont from Massachusetts, and I was there to hear a talk given by Sean Turley, known as The Righteous Russet on Instagram. He is a self-proclaimed Cider Club czar and the Malice columnist emeritus at Portland Press Herald. He's also an attorney when he's not out foraging for apples. And you'll also hear from William Mullen. He is known on Instagram as Palm Queen. And both these guys, if you follow their feed, in Sean's feed, you see him holding the apple in his hand. And for William, he has a much more artistic eye. In fact, so much so that he just released a book this year called Odd Apples. And it's kind of like a coffee table book of these amazing photographs. We're going to first hear from William as he tells us a bit of his background getting into all this, and then they're going to bring us along on this kind of fun overview of apples. And I found it really, really enjoyable. Even though I know a lot of this stuff, there's always something that another person you're talking to brings up and brings you a little bit deeper down the rabbit hole of apple joy. So that's where we're going to go to next. So grab a glass and join this feature presentation that was outdoor at Scott's Farm in Vermont by Sean Turley and William Mullen.
couple years ago, I started a photo project documenting apples. It just kind of happened really naturally. I grew up in the UK and came upon an apple called Egremont Russet. Long story short, fell in love with this rusty, potato-y looking apple that kind of blew my mind in terms of how good it tasted. And I learned about apples being heterozygous and, you know, morphing and manifesting differently all across the world. And I just became obsessed. And when I moved to New York and learned photography, I started a still life project, basically documenting apple expression. And that, you know, as Sean can speak to, just becomes an obsession. And that's been the last, I guess, 4 years of my free time. And I have a book called Odd Apples that was just published by Haja Kunst, which is a German art book publisher.
I'm from Maine. I do a bunch of stuff in Maine. I work with the Maine Heritage Orchard, which is a historic orchard, which has, we're grafted, I think, about 400 different varieties of apples that were historically grown in Maine. I run an apple tasting every year. I forage a lot of fruit for cider makers. I also am on Instagram doing a photo project. I like to joke, but half seriously say that it's kind of the Sears catalog of apples. I don't really kind of have the artsy quality that William, I think, brings so beautifully to it. And just what I try to do is kind of document things for people to reference and also provide a bit of history about these apples. So most of my fall is spent driving around New England looking for apples from wild trees, which we'll talk about a little bit later, to grafted varieties. And then this is, you see some similarities. This is our apple tasting from 2019. And I run a cider club or cider share in Portland. So what we want to start with a little bit is kind of apples 101. So how do we get these different varieties? Where do they come from? If you like one, how do you grow it in your orchard or in your backyard? What's the deal with all those trees you might see on the side of the road? So kind of cover some basics. And please ask questions here because this can seem a little complicated, and getting a good foundation here is really helpful to understanding how amazing this mosaic of apples is and how it represents hundreds of years of growing apples.
Apples are Malus domestica. That's the Latin name. So they're from the genus Malus, which houses, you know, crab apples, wild apples, eating apples, ornamentals. And that itself is housed by the Rosaceae family, which I might be butchering my pronunciation, but that's essentially the rose family, which has been around since the Paleocene and houses, you know, prunus, which is plums, peaches, cherries, almonds, other nuts are not part of prunus, but also in the rose family, apples, pears. So a lot of culturally celebrated, nutritionally important, and economically important plants come from that family. And I would argue that apples are kind of like the ultimate expression of it, dare I say. So that traces all the way back to the Paleocene and Malus. There are ancestors that can be traced all the way back to the Miocene. So this is just millions and millions of years of co-evolution with all the living things on the planet, from birds to, you know, later larger mammals that began eating smaller Malus species and kind of stimulating Malus to create larger, more expensive fruits over time. But actually, this is probably the most important fact that you could know about an apple, is that they don't grow true from seed. So if you take, you know, a black Oxford seed right now and you plant it, it's actually pretty unlikely that you're going to get an apple as beautiful and dark as black Oxford. You're going to get something different. It's going to have some traits of the seed, so some black Oxford traits, but it will also have some traits from a pollinator parent, so whatever little cute bumblebee brought over and, you know, pollinated that little seedling tree. And so because of that, every apple that we eat you know, over here is all the work of grafting. Basically, people will pause. Yeah.
Yeah. To show you.
Yeah.
So this on the left is Duchess of Oldenburg, which they grow here at Scott Farm. It's early September apple, you know, little stripey, kind of cute. And then it's one of its kids, you could say, is Wolf River. This massive cooking apple ripens later, can weigh like 12 ounces to a pound. And so compared to humans, you know, genetically, we're relatively similar to our parents. Apples, not so much. So it's what's called extreme heterozygosity, which basically means that genetically, those seeds can vary tremendously from their parents. So you will get some traits, but as William said, if you planted, you know, this table out into seeds, we would get all new apples. And by new apples, I mean never identified, never have existed in the past. You can name them, they're totally new. So you throw the Macintosh out your window, 20 years later, some other tree is going to be sprouted up there and growing fruit. It could taste great, it could taste terrible, it could be really mealy. Oh, there's all sorts of things. So that's kind of the most important thing. So then that leads to, well, how do you, you know, how are there millions of Red Delicious trees or millions of Honeycrisp trees? One other genetic piece before that. So one thing that also happens is called a spore, which is a bud mutation. This means you're growing, let's say, Honeycrisp. You've got a Honeycrisp tree, and one branch of your tree will suddenly develop slightly differently. It will just kind of mutate on its own, randomly. Okay? So here's a good example of a spore. So this is a historic variety called Adams Pear Maine. As you can see, it's kind of a reddish apple. And then this is its spore, Adams russet, which is all russeted. In fact, one of the most famous spores is called razor russet, which is a golden delicious spore. So golden delicious, I'm sure you've all seen. Razor russet is entirely russeted. It's like a squat apple. And just randomly that happened. So not only do you get seeds growing into new trees, but also branches and trees themselves will kind of mutate, rarely, but will happen, and then develop new characteristics.
Yeah, something kind of amazing, too, about the seed thing is, so say, like, an apple has 5 seeds, and there's, you know, 50 apples on a tree. It's highly unlikely that all those seeds are going to successfully produce a tree. It's actually super rare. But say they did, or there's 100, you know, that's, like, what is that, like, 500 potentially new apples. Yeah, it's pretty mind-blowing.
So when in the 1800s, we'll get to history a little bit later, but documented apples, there are roughly 6,000 to 10,000 varieties of apples. And so this could be people who planted seeds on their farm and just named that tree whatever they wanted. It could be things that we still have today with us. So it's an incredible diversity and makes it very different than really any other fruit in terms of that diversity. But the way, if I wanted to replicate, yes.
Is that unique just to apples, this process?
Pears do this too, but most fruits are by crossing. So you're actually controlling that pollination piece, and what results is much closer to the parents. So here, this idea that a seed is so different than the parents is really apples and pears. So pears, you also will find wild pears if you drive around, that similar process.
Thank you.
Sure. So if you did want to recreate this apple, so let's say you are the lucky person who grew the first Honeycrisp, and you're like, this apple's amazing, I want to give it to all my friends, I want to make lots of money. What you do is you take what's called signwood from the tree, which is a young branch. Okay, this is our friend Matt Kaminsky holding a bunch of signwood from a tree. You do it in the winter when the tree is kind of asleep, and you take that cutting. And then you do what's called grafting, which is this kind of magical process by which you take the tree, the fruit you want to grow, that's that kind of reddish branch, and you take what's called a rootstock, which is your base, and you basically fuse them together. And they'll learn to grow and create a kind of fused state at the scion, and then it'll grow that variety you grafted on. So the variety will grow will be this variety, not the bottom one. So if you wanted to recreate Honeycrisp, you would go get a bunch of this rootstock, you'd get a bunch of little branches of Honeycrisp, you'd graft them all on, and you'd have a Honeycrisp orchard. Okay. So every apple that we have is really a clone of an original tree. There was one original of each of these trees somewhere in the world, many of these from Europe, mostly from the United States, that was recreated through cyanwood. And so you can see this process happen kind of gradually, right? Like, I find an apple I love, I give some to William, Willie gives some to his friends, and then over decades, hundreds of years, this variety is very well known.
Yeah, cultivation fosters sharing.
And so when the trees get to be old, you'll see things called grafts, which is these things these people are pointing at. These are very obvious ones. Oftentimes you can't see them. But that's how you would know this is a tree that someone purposely brought into their orchard, as opposed to grew from seed. Because again, growing from seed would be a totally unique tree, and there would be no grafting involved. You just plop a seed in the ground, and apple pop a apple tree. What Simone was saying about how Zeke converted the orchard from Macintosh into these varieties is a process called topworking. So basically what you do is you chop off part of your tree, you attach that same cyanwood to the tree, like this, and then from those little branches will grow the variety you grafted in. So even though the base is a Macintosh, the tree from that point forward will grow into Black Oxford or Appietolais. So you can take an orchard that you don't like the fruit, and you can convert it entirely into these cool different apples. And so this is what they look like a couple years later. So they grow. They kind of just like know to work together with the base tree. And now these will be your new apple variety that you grafted in to the orchard.
Question.
Yeah.
Is there a high success or a high failure rate among that?
It's. I would say that grafting is hard to do well. You have to expose a very small amount of membrane. But if done well, very successful. So the people who do it professionally, I would say they're in like the 90, 95% range of grafts taking. And when you order trees from a nursery or something, they've already let it grow for about a year or so to make sure that graft takes. So it can fail. But what's fascinating is it doesn't matter what the base tree is, and it doesn't matter what the new variety is. It's just they go, oh, you're an apple, I'm an apple, and they'll link together. So it's totally flexible in that way. And in fact, know plenty of people who have top-worked trees where they'll have a tree, and they'll have eight varieties on that tree. So they'll have every branch will just be a different variety of apple, like a Franken tree apple.
Sure.
Okay, so now a little bit of history. William started touching this, but let's kind of go over it again a little bit as to where apples came from originally. And again, as William said, millions of years ago, and kind of how they came to be these edible things we know. So you want to talk about the museum briefly again?
Yeah. So basically,
here's all of human time, or all of time on the earth.
All of time right there. Apples are part of the roast family, and the ancestors of Mallus can be traced back to the Miocene. And, you know, back then, apples probably looked like tiny little crabs, which were mostly seed. And over time, they got bigger. So consumers of Mallus were probably mostly birds at this point.
Do you want to talk about Malus subversii and just what?
Yeah. So Malus subversii is the wild apple. And this is kind of the progenitor of the apple that we eat today, Malus domestica. Malus subversii is still actually can be found in research orchards and across, I would say, Middle East or Central Asia.
Yeah.
This is a Malus subversii example. It's a sample from the USDA orchard in Geneva. Got another one here. It looks like an egg. And then two more. This one to our left is Niswitzkiana, which is an apple that they actually have here at Scott Farm.
It's right here on the table when you come up and look.
Is sort of the progenitor of all red flesh apples. Almost all red flesh apples can be traced back to Niswitzkiana. And this apple can be traced back to the Tian Shan Mountains, specifically Kyrgyzstan, where Malus subversii became Malus domestica, which is the apple that we eat today. And this was basically a long, many thousands of year process where larger mammals started eating Malus subversii and basically Malice responded by making larger, sweeter fruits, sensing that there was something, you know, that needed more nutrition and the tree could travel far or further if it did that, basically ensuring its survival.
Right.
So, yeah, that's from there. Basically, apples were then later consumed by humans who did all sorts of things with it, like make cider.
They
get kind of like, basically they travel up from Asia through Europe eventually, and get kind of wrapped up in our economic systems essentially. This apple here, which is also an apple from Scott Farm, Candle Synap, looks like a candle. And is, for me, actually one of the more kind of interesting examples of what I see kind of Malice expressing itself, maybe to larger mammals. Candle Synap is really beautiful and stunning and looks like a lantern on the tree. And, you know, without sort of anthropomorphizing the tree too much, feels like some animacy, some agency in the tree presenting something really beautiful that, you know, it wants to be consumed so it can spread its seed and further the species. And that feels like the only way I can explain it looking so vastly different from most other apples in shape. It feels like, yeah, a lantern in the dark, essentially. It's also a really delicious apple.
So one thing that people across time have experimented with, particularly in the United States, is using these wild apples to try to reintroduce some of this genetic material, which is actually really important right now because with climate change, there's a lot more threats on apple trees, particularly things getting warmer the farther north you go, pests, bacteria, various things that used to never appear, let's say in New England, are now here. And our varieties that we've historically grown here just might not do well. They might be really susceptible to something that, you know, used to be in the Mid-Atlantic is now here. And also these wild apples have really strange qualities, like the red flesh we were talking about. And one of the people that I think I can safely say we both idolized quite a bit is this guy, Albert Etter from California. He bred apples. So what he would do is he would control that process of pollinating the flower and trying to cross apples. He also planted a lot of stuff from seed. And what he developed were all sorts of red-fleshed dessert apples. And by dessert, I mean fresh-eating apples. But those same wild traits could help protect against various diseases and threats that today might wreck your... Like Honeycrisp, for example, is an apple that is very susceptible to a variety of things that kill it. It's actually very labor-intensive to make Honeycrisp. So trying to figure out genetically what there is that we can introduce or cross to create new apples that'll survive is like kind of the cutting edge of apple work that's happening.
Yeah, the process that Sean was speaking to is referred to as basically open pollination. So what Albert Etter did was, get apples like Nijmegen or Surprise, which is a German apple that is pink inside, that is a child of Nijmegen. And other apples, plant them, and then basically take their seedlings and plant those. So basically allowing every, you know, basic, well, curating apples with traits that he really liked, wild and cultivated, and allowing them to naturally cross in the environment. So that by also doing that, he's kind of getting apples that are responding to those conditions as well, which I would say is super advantageous.
Yeah, and this is a very laborious process. So a lot of universities do this work of crossing apples. And I mean, they're planting out thousands and thousands of unique trees and then selecting one out of every 10,000 and then seeing how that does, you know, growing into a full tree and how it survives. But to William's point, when you see these seedling apples on the side of the road, what's interesting about them is they've clearly adapted to their environment. Right, like they're alive, even though they're not being cared for, and they seem to be thriving. So, what is it genetically about that apple tree that loves being, you know, in this area of Vermont or some area of Maine? So, trying to unpack all this is kind of a really complex, interesting process that takes a very long time. Because again, you can't just like in a lab combine two apples and arrive at the perfect apple, because every time you cross, the relationship to the parents is a bit more attenuated, and you just got, it's just trial and error over and over again. So now transitioning, so as William said, the apple moves largely by animals from Central Asia to the Middle East to Europe. When it gets to Europe, there's already farms there. It's pretty well established. So apples are grown kind of selectively. But when colonists from Europe came to the United States, it was inconceivable to bring a tree. So what they brought were seeds. Okay? So they were not replicating the old varieties. They bring cyanwood usually. They brought seeds with them. And the idea was when they got to wherever they're going to go, they planted the seeds, they would get new apple trees, and then again, they could plant those seeds. And this is kind of the Johnny Appleseed story of sorts. Johnny Appleseed attempted to kind of market this. He wasn't that successful. He would just basically, as colonists moved west, he would plant out bunches of seeds, and then people would be like, that's nice, I'll just plant my own apples, thank you. But this idea of seeds being the kind of genus of kind of American apples is what leads to this huge explosion in diversity. Because again, if every farm is planting 10 unique trees and you have thousands and thousands of farms across the United States, you're going to get tremendous variety of apples. So that's kind of the first wave of apple development in the United States is seedling apples. So we usually eat apples fresh, but on a farm, you'd have apples for livestock. You've had apples for cider. You've had apples for eating. You've had apples for cooking. You've had apples that store well, that you wouldn't eat until like March or April, so that you could have this crop that you can keep for months and months. So you wouldn't want to just grow like Macintosh, which, you know, tastes great, but will kind of, you know, turn to mush in like a month. You'd have this whole variety of apples. And one big part of that was cider. And what's important to realize is that cider, both we think of as like an alcoholic drink that, and by the way, when I mean cider, I don't mean sweet cider. I mean hard cider, fermented cider. But it served another purpose. In a lot of areas of the country, water wasn't actually safe to drink. And so people would drink cider as kind of their daily beverage. So there's all sorts of kind of historical records of massive barrels of cider and, you know, kind of like the workers coming in from a field and drinking cider, clearly getting buzzed on the job, but also keeping them safe. So cider production and cider apples was like the biggest use of apples, not market apples, not, you know, fresh eating. It was mostly to drink. And those, as will taste, have different qualities than fresh eating apples. Apples and cider also made their way into politics. The 1840 election was between Martin Van Buren. I know you all know this. I mean, this is like common knowledge. Martin Van Buren, here he is. He ran against William Henry Harrison, who in 1840 kind of ran as like a man of the people. And so he associated himself with a log cabin and hard cider because that was like, you know, the drink of the people. So here's Martin Van Buren, you know, drinking some champagne, and here's him trying cider. He looks fairly perplexed and disturbed. Here's William Henry Harrison as a train with a hard cider barrel, barreling into Martin Van Buren and knocking him over. One thing that Simone touched on briefly that is actually a bit of a misconception is temperance and the importance of prohibition and stuff in terms of cider. So most people who grew apples for cider did so on their own farms. There wasn't like a market. They weren't selling cider. They were just drinking their own cider. And if it went bad, they'd just have their own vinegar. And although temperance was obviously a big movement, particularly in New England, there's all sorts of myths about people running around with like axes cutting down trees that didn't actually happen. Temperance existed, and maybe it encouraged some people to stop drinking cider, but there wasn't like a mass movement to like eradicate apple trees and cider apples. Instead, what really made the biggest difference were a couple things. One is the railroad. Because once the railroad reached Washington State, which is like the Garden of Eden of apple growing, it became much cheaper to just ship apples from Washington and buy them here. So you have cheaper apples coming east, which then was like, why am I, you know, growing these apples that are hard to grow? There's all these disease issues. I could just buy an apple and it's cheaper. So that's number one. So that might mean, again, I'm not going to produce as many myself, or farms are going to honestly just go out of business because they can't compete. And then the second was the push towards kind of commodity apples. Does anyone know what this is? It's the ultimate commodity apple. It is a Red Delicious. Yes, you're supposed to boo at this point. Boo, Red Delicious, boo. So the Stark Brothers Nursery was this massive conglomerate nursery in the early 1900s who would sell and kind of push this idea of, you know, don't grow those dumb historic varieties. They don't always grow well. A lot of apple trees are biennial by nature, meaning they'll take a year off. Don't do that. Grow Red Delicious. Red Delicious is marketable. It's sweet. It'll hang out on the shelf for like 4 or 5 months, which is disturbing. And you'll make tons of money. And so that was the movement, was capitalism kind of changed what people thought they would grow. Instead of growing exciting, cool stuff that, you know, people look at and are like, oh, what's that? You just be like, why don't I just grow only Red Delicious? After Red Delicious came the next kind of commodity apple, which was Golden Delicious, which also Stark Brothers controlled. And here's actually an ad in one of their catalogs saying, you know, I'm sure apocryphal, someone saying, oh, I used to grow all these interesting apples. I just grow Golden Delicious now. I make tons of money. It's way easier. They fruit every year. This is great. You know, no Wolf Rivers, no Hubbards and none such. Get rid of those apples. That is the first Golden Delicious tree in a cage. To protect it from people taking cyanwood from it. So as you can see, there's like a guard guarding the tree. And here's some of the early Golden Delicious. And as you're noticing, the emphasis is on size and color, like yellow and red are the only apples that matter. And you can see here advertising, you know, look how much redder our Delicious is than the historic one. As I said, you can't do this purposely, but what this represents is a sport. So if millions of people are growing Red Delicious, every so often one branch will develop a new type of Red Delicious. Maybe it's redder, maybe it lasts longer, maybe it's sweeter. And then Stark Brothers Nursery, for example, would put it in a cage, as you can see, and then sell it. I'd be like, you should all grow Stark Delicious. Again, it lasts longer. All these commodity reasons why people would want to grow apples. Not related to flavor, not diversity, not experimentation. Just you have so many acres of land, you want to make money on your orchard, grow these apples.
Yeah, especially in post-war, World War II America, you have basically the super marketization of apples and lots of other plants that we eat. Refrigeration and refrigerated trucks also accelerate this. Just like the railroads, apples can keep for longer, stay fresher, and so seasonality is kind of no longer important. Keeping apples take a huge leap forward here, and now we have apples like Cosmic Crisp, which are, you know, said to last an entire year, essentially. So, you know, several qualities become super important over all else, which is, you know, simplicity and beauty. So red, green, yellow, keeping qualities, and also just more generic flavor profile. So the Starkling Delicious kind of starts this, and this gets accelerated when, you know, people no longer look to, you know, farmers markets or orchards for their apples and to discover new things. They start looking to their supermarkets. And so everything becomes homogenized really rather quickly when the supermarket only sort of fits a certain aesthetic, a certain taste quality.
Just to add to that for a second, the other thing the supermarket does is it gets rid of all this diverse class of different types of apples for different uses. So you can't go to a supermarket today and get a baking apple or a storage apple or a cider apple. All they sell is fresh eating apples. So the idea of apples for different purposes collapses. And it's just, what are the fresh, sweet tasting apples I can buy to eat? Which is sad because, for example, a lot of these older varieties are great for pies. And most of the varieties you buy in a supermarket are terrible for pies. Like Macintosh just collapses when you make a pie with it. But again, you don't have another option if that's where you're getting your apples from. That is the apple you could buy, and it's local, and so you're like, oh, cool, I'll make a Macintosh pie. So not only is it sort of flavor profiles and looks, it's also, there's no emphasis on different uses. It's just fresh eat. Apples are things you put in your lunchbox and eat. That's it.
Yeah, and you know, looks and flavor are also not mutually exclusive qualities. They are intertwined. So, you know, Sean put a lot of russeted apples out here on the table. Russeting is a quality that's really discouraged by supermarkets. It's seen as a visual blemish, dull looking, etc. But russeted apples are often the most delicious in flavor, far more delicious than any supermarket apple. They're often great for cooking, great for cider. They have really, honestly, really multi-purpose uses, which should essentially kind of make it actually rather friendly in a capitalist system that favors efficiency and multi-purpose.
Yeah, but they're brown, William.
But they're brown, they're dull, they look like potatoes, and they also have funny, funky names with long histories that can't be reduced to two syllables, although I'm sure maybe someday that'll happen. Curiously, russeting is still and has been historically accepted in pears. But
like Bosque is obviously a totally rusted pear. But apples, boo, no rusted. Do you want to talk about Lucy Glow?
Yeah, so there is, I will say, some diversity happening now in the supermarket scene. There's one apple, Opal, that's like really interesting for being banana yellow and actually kind of having an interesting flavor. It tastes like coconuts and pineapples and bananas. Or Lucy Glow, which is basically a hidden rose cross with Honeycrisp. So kind of an apple for the Instagram age, perhaps. It is pink inside. It has kind of an ombre pink.
How's it taste?
I think it tastes like a slushy, essentially. Like a slushy that you might have had I would say, pre-9/11 America, where things are optimistic and sugary. And there's lots of really pink and really blue gender reveal aesthetics. So there is kind of this, like, trying to diversify and market apples in a different way happening now, somewhat unsuccessfully.
Yeah, Cosmic Crisp has been relatively a failure. So it was developed by a university breeding program, like Honeycrisp was. Honeycrisp was developed by the University of Minnesota. And again, this is a decades-long process of crossing things, planting seeds, growing apples, seeing what traits they have. And Cosmic Crisp, for example, had a $10 million marketing campaign behind it. Millions of trees were planted in Washington State. And they really pushed it. It's like this exciting apple. You know, like, you guys love Honeycrisp. Now here's Cosmic Crisp. This is the other thing about modern apples, is they almost all have a crisp in the name, because focus groups say that people want crunchy apples. They don't want soft apples. You know, especially they're fresh eating, and so you just want a big, like, crunchy bite. And it hasn't really caught on, because it takes a lot for an apple to catch on, and people are really specific about the apples they like, because maybe from childhood they have favorites, or they've just always, you know, grown up with a particular apple and see it in the supermarket all the time. So sometimes there's more marketing and hype, I would say, than, like, actual success in this. But so there is, like, a... Beyond this, like, historic piece, there is still this, like, commodity-driven, new product-driven kind of way of making apples. And again, as you said, maybe valuing some of the looks, and they might seem different on the shelf, but not in a way that necessarily is super useful, but a lot of pretty beautiful fruit.
Yeah, it's kind of so, you know, maybe when, if you have a hidden rose or you bought one, say, at the stand, you know, you'll think, why is this apple, what's wrong with this apple? Why is it not delicious enough for the supermarket? It's also beautiful inside. There's a lot of reasons for that, but I would say one of them might be taste. It is quite tart and takes some time to soften up, which makes it rather supermarket unfriendly. So that flavor quality overrides how beautiful it is. And an apple like Lucy Glow, which I should note, does not have a W at the end of Glow.
It's
G-L-O. I'm pretty sure. Yeah. You know, being crossed with Honeycrisp is sweeter and syrupy and not tart and lacking the kind of tartness that anthocyanins often bring. So things like blueberries, strawberries, cranberries, these are all super anthocyanin-rich, and there's usually a tartness that comes with that compound.
And that's what makes an apple red. or blueberries blue, like bluish red, is that genetic character, which is when we were going back and looking at Albert Edder's grenadines, that's what makes these red apples. And you'll see some red apples here, like Redfield, Neat's Whiskiana, Hidden Rose, that have those qualities. And a lot of the commercialization piece that we're talking about is still happening. So, for example, Hidden Rose on the table, beautiful apple. Do you want to talk about how
Hidden Rose is fascinating to me for a lot of different reasons. I think one of the things that interests both Sean and I especially is the ways that, you know, malice and apples get wrapped up in our human history and our systems. So Hidden Rose is kind of a really low-key good example of this. Basically, it was found by a man named Lucky Newell in the 1960s in Arley, Oregon.
So it would have been growing from seed.
Yeah.
Right?
So
just a tree out somewhere happened to be a red-fleshed apple.
Yeah, so imagine that, being the first person to discover Hidden Rose and bite into it and see this like really vibrant neon pink flesh. So basically, Lucky Newell doesn't do anything with this apple but enjoy it. And then he passes, and a man named Lewis Kimsey buys his property and also then, you know, rediscovers Hidden Rose for himself, or Arley Redflesh, which is what he names it. So he names it after the town, Arley, where it was discovered, and he starts selling cyanwood to people so that they can graft it, and basically sharing this apple. So cut to, you know, basically 21 years later, one of his customers, a man named Eric Schwartz, decides to trademark this apple as Hidden Rose, which basically now forbids it from being sold as anything else, and now requires, you know, I think registration to commercially sell it. So he's now capitalized and commoditized this apple, which was once basically, you know, free and available with the simple purchase of cyanwood, which will run you, what, $5, $10? And then you can have, you know, Hidden Rose for as long as your trees last. And anyone could grow it. Now you need to be part of a specific club to grow it and use the name. Although I think that is not as tightly enforced as one might imagine, still I find the attempt really rather fascinating. And actually, to get around this, a lot of growers have renamed their Hidden Rose another name. So you hear of Mountain Rose, which is basically Hidden Rose. It's genetically identical, but grown in a mountainous area of Oregon, the Mount Hood River Valley. In New York, there is an orchard called Temescal that I love, that had to call their Hidden Rose Pinkaboo, which is an atrocious name. You know, they had to do that because they didn't want to essentially pay to use the trademark name. So you have this, you know, beautiful, wonderful apple, this gift from the tree, basically being capitalized by a greedy person named Eric.
Another piece of this, so you've got, again, this big push to commodity apples, clearly a counterweight and kind of movement against it. So you've got people throughout the country. These are two examples. This is Lee Calhoun, who relocated hundreds of southern apples that were historically grown in the south. That's John Bunker from Maine, who did the same thing in New England. So basically going back to old records, meeting with old people who live on farms, trying to figure out what they're growing. If they find a lost variety that was grown hundreds of years ago, finding it, grafting it again, sharing it widely, to then recreate this historic record. Because really, most orchards don't have this. And so it was about finding those apples, getting cyanwood, shouting to the heavens about that you have it, encouraging people to grow it. People like Zeke then deciding, I love these apples, I'll graft them into the orchard. And then, you know, decade two later, this is what you have. But this has been a very laborious, intense process of like historical detection work to go find all this stuff and identify it and look at pictures and read descriptions and try things to basically rebuild what we lost over the 20th century, which really almost entirely disappeared. Other than maybe, again, like some heirloom varieties like Macintosh surviving. It's been a lot of work, but we now get to literally eat the fruits of that work through trying these apples that, again, maybe for 100 years have not been available.
The last thing we want to talk about commoditization is kind of blemishes, if you want to.
Yeah, so, you know, what keeps apples pristine and shiny is usually spraying, although not always. It's also possible to not spray and come out with really exceptionally pristine apples. But most of the apples that you'll buy in the supermarket and sometimes farmers markets are heavily sprayed to arrive to you completely blemish-free and of, you know, suitable market size. And really, when you find apples, you know, along the roadsides or on, you know, completely unsprayed orchards, you'll find some quote-unquote blemishes. Things like, as you can see here, sooty blotch, which is basically bacterial. And is this, you know, looks like it's been, you know, sitting in front of a truck that's spewing fumes at it. But it's actually quite beautiful, and it's also harmless to you. And it's usually the sign of, I think, a healthy, you know, or, you know, maybe we'll not put a qualifier on it, but just the microbiome of an orchard. So it is part of the natural process. Other things like apple scab, which are little pink marks on the apple, are another basically just reaction from the fruit to its environment. So these things are, russeting is another example of this. And sometimes you'll see it rather extremely, apples will even crack. And sometimes flavors intensify from that. Pink pearls that I've had, which is a pink flesh apple that have been sort of cracked in some way, were more pink and more flavorful. So sometimes these, you know, blemishes and stressors can be really good for apples in terms of flavor. And yet they are, you know, completely erased from most of the apples available to us today based on aesthetics, essentially. Actually, right. Another kind of, before we, yeah. One of my last ones, this is a Sam Young apple. It's very similar in flavor to Ashmead's Kernel. It's an Irish apple. But this line that you see going down on it, you also see it on some of the knobbed russets. That's called European soft fly. And it's basically a fly that, I mean, this is maybe going to gross people out, but just, you know, it's all outdoors. This fly burrows itself into the apple when it's young and lays eggs in the apple. And before you eat the apple, these eggs hatch. And the flies come out of the apple and they leave like these tracks, basically, these track marks on the apple. And so, yeah, no worries. There's no soft flies in your fruit. But it does leave this kind of rather beautiful mark. And the flavor is often excellent from these apples. So, again, these blemishes, whether by bacteria or bugs, are really actually really special and delicious and just sort of the sign of life in the orchard, life around the tree.
So we're going to move on to tasting apples in a moment, which again are going to be set up behind us at the tables. But we wanted to kind of talk about each of these apples to give you a bit more of a context rather than just trying 8 apples and saying, oh, those are nice. So I will make some general notes because I spend a lot of time trying apples and writing tasting notes. There's some things to focus on, right? So like obviously flavor is big, probably the most important. We should also think about texture. You know, some people like a big crunch. Some people like softer apples. You can think about how juicy it is. Some of the russets can be a little dry. Sometimes it really amplifies the sugars. And then juicy apples can sometimes taste watery. But again, that could be what you want for various things. And then the other piece is, again, when you taste an apple fresh, is realizing it might have a different use. So it might not taste good fresh. And in fact, a couple of the apples you're going to taste won't taste that great now. But if you buy them and put them away or you bake them, they will taste wonderful. So first apple, you don't have to taste these in any order, and I just want to go through them briefly, is Roxbury Russet. So this is an example of a colonial apple. It was first promulgated in the 1640s and is still with us. It's very acidic, it's bright, crunchy, it has russeting, as you can see. It doesn't actually, when it russets, and you can see on the table, it doesn't fully russet, so like part of it will stay green. So this is like an example of a historic apple that, again, has been grown in the United States, coming on to almost 400 years. The other type of apple one of the other types of apples you're going to taste are storage apples. So this might sound strange, but some apples taste way better in like 5 months. So basically, over the course of putting them in the cellar, ideally a cellar because the cellar has a bit more moisture than your refrigerator, but refrigerator is fine. This apple's sugars will really develop and kind of crystallize and become more complex and will legitimately taste better in February than they will today. So example of this from Maine, my state, is Black Oxford. So Black Oxford has a nickname called the 4th of July apple. That's because you can legitimately eat it the following 4th of July, and it'll still be very good.
I can confirm this.
So if this is an apple that you would buy today, and you would try it and be like, "Ah, it's nice, it's an apple." But if you ate it in February, it'd be very rich and creamy and like has like berry notes to it. It is gorgeous. But again, I'm telling you this long story. If you were at a supermarket, you saw this apple, you're like, "That apple sucks," and you would just toss it and not buy it again. But if you know the purpose, it gives you a different context in which to enjoy it. Wine sap is one of the apples out there, which is a traditional American storage apple. So try it today, but also, you know, look for those type of apples and put them away for months.
Ananas Renette, which ananas means pineapple. So Ananas Renette is known for having this intense pineapple-like flavor. It's this tiny French apple that even also has this fun little spotting. So the spots on an apple are called lenticels. And Ananas Renette has this cute little spotting that kind of reminds me of the, you know, little dots on a pineapple. But yeah, it has a really nice sort of tropical pineapple acidic flavor. It packs a real punch for a small snacking size apple.
In French, you're going to try French apple and a British apple. These countries obviously also have hundreds of years of apple development. And I told you about how seeds came to the United States. Well, now today you can get scion wood from England, from France, and actually graft these into your orchards, which is what Zeke did in terms of bringing over apples like this. And then we're also going to try Ashmead's Kernel, which combines a lot of these things. It's a reasonable cooking apple. It is a russet, and it's an English apple. And so in England, the commodity apples, I would say, have more diversity than we have. Like the Egremont russet you mentioned is falling in love with as a kid, is a brown potato-like apple, but it's for sale pretty widely, where that would never make its way into an American shelf. It's not red or big.
And also has a funny name.
It also does have a funny name. Kernel, by the way, means seedling. So this means it's Ashmead's seedling tree. So another thing, we've kind of touched on this a little bit with Hidden Rose, are modern apples. And by that, I mean new discoveries. So people have gone out into the world, they picked an apple off a tree on the side of the road, in the field, wherever, and they're like, "This apple's great." And so then they've tried to popularize it, or in the case of Hidden Rose, trademark it. And so this is Hudson Golden Gem, which is a gorgeous apple. Visually and in flavor, it has like a very pear-like quality to it. It has beautiful russeting. It has a very tall, kind of statuesque kind of character, and is wonderful for fresh eating. It's soft, and again, that's actually getting to cooking apples in a moment. If the apple's soft, it's probably not good for baking. Sauce is good. Fresh eating is good. Do you want to talk about your favorite?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite apples. This is called Cabernet Blanc. It is another French apple whose name means white apple of winter. And some of the most beautiful examples of them will have this extremely intense ridging. This was, I believe, Louis XIII's favorite apple, and it was selected to be cultivated in the garden in Orleans, France. It's from Normandy, and I always like to say that this kind of like intense ridging that grows higher and higher sometimes sort of mimics the palace. I think it's Michael Abbey or Michel Abbey in Normandy. I'm probably butchering the pronunciation. I don't even really remember the name correctly, but it's that palace on the water or castle in Normandy that kind of has the, you know, intense heights. Colville reminds me of this. And it's a great cooking apple. It really holds its structure in baking, and is also said to be like the choice apple for tart tatin in France.
difference.
Yeah.
So again, fresh eating, you like tart apples. I not so much. And it's very tart. It is very hard. But again, if you put it in a pie and bake it for an hour, it'll still have some residual structure to it, which is often what you're looking for in a cooking apple. So here, again, is an apple that if you saw it on the shelves in the supermarket, that look a little weird, but has this other purpose for which it's been kept around. We've already touched this a bit, but russeted apples, there are plenty on the table. There are plenty for sale. This is, again, a skin condition that's triggered by various environmental factors. Some apples will never russet. Other apples will russet quite frequently, which is why we call them russets. And it tends to kind of concentrate the flavor a bit. So they tend to have like more complex sugars. And we're going to be tasting Belle de Boskoop, which is a apple from the Netherlands. Big, bright acidity, really rich in flavor. And then the last one, and we're letting you off easy on this, is cider apples.
Yeah.
So cider fruit does not taste good fresh, usually. What you want in a cider apple, and what I spend most of my fall driving around trying to find, are wild trees that are bitter in flavor. So kind of like an olive or like an oversteeped tea in flavor. And are sweet, so they have sugars, because I'm going to ferment them, and I want the yeast to eat something. And have almost no acid. So they taste weird. They taste very off-putting. You would never eat them fresh with cheese or something like that. They taste terrible. But fermented, they're wonderful. And that bitterness translates into tannins when you ferment it. So the sugars get eaten by the yeast. The tannins become the structure of your drink. But if you use acidic apples and cider, what happens is all the sugar gets eaten, and all you're left with is acid. And although some of you might drink vinegar, I choose not to, and that's because that's really intense. So apples have been selected over hundreds of years that have these qualities. They're bitter for the tannins, they have sugar, and maybe a little bit of acidity, and Kingston Black is a great example. So Kingston Black we're going to try, it is tannic and has that bitterness. It's also sweet, it's also slightly acidic, which means actually people across the country, it's a terrible apple to grow. It's very difficult to grow, but you can make a single varietal cider from it. So you can just take Kingston Black, ferment it, and you'll get a little bit of acid, you'll get a nice amount of alcohol, and you'll get some body and structure. But again, in tasting it, it's not going to taste like these other apples. It's not meant to be used like these other apples. But it is interesting to kind of check in to see kind of what that is.
Yeah, the skin is quite tough and tannic, and then the flesh is acidic with some fruit. I say fruit salad flavors.
Yeah.
Richie Brady, if you're out there listening in Ireland right now, these guys are working it, right? They're finding ways to describe it, making it really attainable for people to get it, and using verbiage that works. If you don't know who I'm talking about, Richie is someone who just wrote a master's thesis on the living language of cider as he's trying to get into the lexicon of cider. And how do we describe it? What language are we using? So it's so cool how everything kind of overlaps. And this was delightful. You once again heard from Sean Turley, The Righteous Russet, and William Mullen, Palm Queen, both on Instagram. Definitely follow them. And I'll have a link in the show notes and at the resource page at ciderchat.com to William's new book called Odd Apples. And with that, Ciderville, I leave you here. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
Like cider, we like palms, we love orchards and having fun. There is a reason,
there is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is. There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet. We like cider, we like palms, we
orchards, having some fun.
There is a reason
why we do it like this. Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we do it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Oh yes, there is.
There is a reason. We like walking through the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Oh yes, we do.
We like palms.
Oh yes, we do.
We love orchards, having some fun. There is a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There's a reason why we do it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum.
There is a reason why we drink it like this.
Ba-da-da-dum. Ba-da-da-dum.
We like walking down the orchards, dancing in the streets, smelling all the blossoms, kicking up our feet.
Oh yeah.
We like cider.
Ba-da-da-dum.
We like palms.
Oh yes, we do.
We like orchards, having some fun.
Yeehaw!